Welcome to our program, the program that challenges religious stereotypes. Contrary to popular opinion, we believe that you can be religious and be intelligent at the same time. Contrary to popular opinion, we believe that you can be religious and be political at the same time. Ouch! I know that gets some of you right there in the stomach. And it is that second point, that ouch point, which will make up most of our discussion today. So, you think Christianity shouldn't have anything to do with politics? Most of the original abolitionists, most of the original people who spoke out against slavery were Christians. And a whole century later, when Martin Luther King spoke out against segregation, he did it as the Reverend Martin Luther King, you will recall. Should these movements not have taken place? Does one have to lay aside the foundation of their moral principles before they go to the voting booth? You see, all laws are the result of somebody's standard of morality. Should we use the humanist standard instead? Folks, I've debated humanists. They're every bit as religious. They make ultimate statements about reality by faith. They can't back it up with anything. If not Christian morality, it might be humanist morality. These are some of the questions we'll discuss today with a very special guest, but there's no questioning the intelligence of my non-stereotypical co-host, Sharon Cashard. Welcome, Sharon.
Hi. It's the time I smoked the cigar in the backyard that gives you that impression, huh, Bob? That non-stereotypic comment you made?
Sharon, we're on a Christian station. She didn't really say anything about cigars.
Well, I get the privilege today to introduce our guest, Hugh Hewitt. Many of you probably know Hugh is the host of a nationally syndicated radio show heard in over 70 cities nationwide. But less known is the fact that he's a professor of law at Chapman University and teaches constitutional law. He's also the author of blog, Understanding the Information Reformation That's Changing Your World, as well as the New York Times bestseller author of If It's Not Close, They Can't Cheat, and They Still Try to When It's Not Close. That's my little editorial comment. He wrote many other books and writes for the weekly column, the Weekly Standard, and it's called the Weekly Daily Standard Online. But I think this is the best way to introduce Hugh. I got this from World Magazine.
So that was not the best way?
No. Here's the best way. This is it.
Now you're going to introduce him the best way.
Broadcasting from a Southern California studio, tucked into a mall behind an Asian noodle joint, the center-right conservative skips easily from topic to topic. The Bush victory, the Democrats' spectacular implosion, Osama bin Laden, the judicial nomination process. Simultaneously, Mr. Hewitt interviews guests, Googles, scans articles online, trades cues with his producers, chats with studio visitors, keeps an eye on CNN, and sips Diet Coke. Now, I have just one question for a man that can do all that. You cannot be from Mars, Hewitt. You're from Venus, aren't you?
No, I'm from. I'm just from Ohio.
All
great things come from most of the country. Good presidents and Diet Coke, I think, is bottled there. So I just put it down to my Ohio upbringing.
I think this election put Ohio on the map. Some of us had never heard of Ohio.
Now that's
the last
terrible,
election.
Bob. That's terrible. It is the 17th state. I think technically it's had more presidents than Virginia because Washington and Madison were born on English soil. I think that generally speaking, the Indians and the Browns and the Cavaliers are the best sports franchise. And I could go on if you'd want to talk Ohio.
Well, Hugh, for what it's worth.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. We are honored. And for what it's worth, being a Californian, I'd put any state above California these days, although Florida's running neck and neck, I must say. Hugh, could you begin by telling us a little bit about your Christian background? You're known as kind of a political talk show host, but I know your faith is important to you. I know you speak on retreats and things of that nature. When did your faith become so important to you as a child, as a teenager, as an adult?
It's always been important to me as far as I can remember. I was raised Roman Catholic, but I was a Presbyterian today. I left about 15 years ago from Roman Catholicism, convinced and persuaded and prompted by God that that was where I was called to be. But I have many, many dear friends and Christian friends in the Catholic Church, as I'm sure you do. The tradition of the Reformed Church, though, is one of sort of testing everything against Scripture and testing everything individually. And I just think that that is what we're called to do nowadays, even though I celebrate with our Catholic brothers the elevation of Benedict XVI, who I think is a great, marvelous man and quite an intellect. I've been doing a lot of work this week trying to figure out who this fellow is, who was last week Joseph Cardinal Ratzinger and is this week Benedict XVI. And I'm I'm very impressed with him and with much of what he has written. I spent a lot of time interviewing people that have known him. So I've always been a Christian. I've always been active politically since the time I was 16 or 17. I've never thought there was a tension between either of those two things. And in fact, there not being a tension goes back to the beginning of our country. You mentioned the abolitionists, whether it was William Lloyd Garrison or his colleagues of the 1850s and 60s. But I'd go back to John Woolman, a Quaker itinerant preacher of the 1600s, and how he immediately began to campaign against slavery in the early American years, or John Adams, who long before there was a Revolutionary War was abhorrent, just absolutely shocked by slavery. Or on the across the water, William Wilberforce, a great politician at the end of the 1800s, 18th century, beginning of the 19th century, who campaigned tirelessly in Parliament from his Christian worldview to end slavery and the international slave trade. So I think there's never been a contradiction up through today. I mean, I think it's great that there are liberals out there who base their liberal, though wrong-headed, beliefs on what they understand to be their religious worldview. I think the much sounder worldview is conservative or center-right, as I like to call it, and I think that can be easily based upon Christian values and principles. But the idea that somehow, you know, the most important thing in your life, your relationship with God, ought to be segregated from how you act in the world is silly. It's also not biblical.
And it's absolutely outrageous. And I think some of the liberals are inconsistent with this, because I remember when John Kerry was running for president, I actually watched him on TV at some African-American churches, and there he is going, "Faith must be genuine. If you can't take your faith to the voting booth, it's not real faith." And then when he's asked about abortion, we get this classic, very original, incredibly cutting-edge answer. "Oh, me personally? I'm against abortion, but who am I to impose my religious beliefs?" It's such incredible hypocrisy.
Well, that's the my friend Cecil Murray pastored First African Methodist Episcopal Church in Los Angeles for, I think, 30 years. And I got to know him when PBS sent me out with a microphone and a camera in the middle 1990s to interview different people of faith. And Pastor Murray, who a long-time giant in the Democratic Party in South Los Angeles, every Sunday before every election, every Democrat elected wannabe shows up at First AME in South Central for a rally. I mean, during services. And I think that's great. Mm-hmm. I don't think that violates separation of church and state. I think that's just great. For historical reasons, the African-American population in America is decidedly Democratic. I think too bad for the politics of the African-American community, because the Democratic Party takes them for granted. But their concerns are concerns of what they say, justice and poverty and empowerment, and they view the Democratic Party as the appropriate receptacle for those things. There's nothing wrong with that. That's where his worldview takes him. He's a Christian. I'm a Christian. We believe in the same saving power of Jesus Christ, but I'm not going to tell him not to act on his politically on his understanding of the gospel, and he's never told me that.
And it's Hugh, with your law background, maybe you could settle this myth out there. Isn't it true that nowhere in our Constitution do we even find the words separation between church and state? Wasn't that originally from a letter that Thomas Jefferson wrote to the Danbury Baptist Association?
Yes, it is. And I went to I was on a part of a program on Wednesday night this week with Judge Kenneth Starr. And Judge Starr is now Dean of Pepperdine Law School, and he gave about a 30-minute summation of all the popular misconceptions about the Establishment and Free Exercise Clauses. And then he ran through the last 60 years of chaos in the courts, which have attempted to reconcile various, quote, tests. Well, it was very easy. What the framers meant was that the federal government would never establish a particular religion that you would be obliged to support with your tax dollars, nor would they be allowed to interfere with those states which had established religions at the time, excuse me, as the Virginians had, a mandated public support for the Anglicans, as did Massachusetts. And so they intended to keep the federal government from starting a church.
Well, we're going to have to go to a break here, Hugh. This is a fascinating discussion. There is no separation between church and state in the Constitution, but there is a separation between a radio program and a commercial break, and
very clever.
Will be right back. You're listening to The Bob Siegel Show with Hugh Hewitt. And we're back. Our very special guest today, a nationally syndicated radio talk show host, Hugh Hewitt. Hugh, we were in the middle of talking about separation between church and state. Did you have any more that you wanted to mention about that before we go on to other questions?
Yes, I do think that it is okay for the Constitution to have evolved. I don't want to go back and say that we should have a Christian country. I think that would not reflect well upon the diversity and the plurality we have here. But we do not have to have a government that is hostile to Christian belief. It's absurd to be hostile to Christian belief. It's a Christian country. Even if it's not a Christian government, it's a Christian country. And this continuing war upon the idea of Christians appearing in the public square and this increasing hostility to people of faith is, I think, alarming for anyone who's steeped in American history.
Well, and I'm out at universities a lot doing debates with atheists, and I read their literature, and they say things like Christianity is the greatest evil that the world has ever known. Now, I find it a little bit disingenuous, whereas on one hand, they'll claim that constitutionally we need to separate church and state. But the truth is, if they could ever have a constitutional convention and rewrite the Constitution and just outlaw, not religion, but I believe the only religion they actually would outlaw is Christianity, I believe they would do so. So it seems a little bit disingenuous when they're quoting from the Constitution. Of course, it's not really in the Constitution, but they're seemingly quoting from the Constitution. And yet, if they could change it, they would.
Yep, I think they would. And they can't really change it by virtue of the provisions made for change, the amendment process. You know, every single member of Congress, with the exception of, I believe, two or three, identify themselves as a believer in one, in either Christianity or Judaism. Yeah. They believe in God. And so the atheists you debate are a splinter group, quite small, quite vocal, and quite in need of the money they raise from such demonstrations of agony over what America genuinely is. And I would prefer to ignore them, Bob. I know that the students like to have a good debate, and I know you do a good service there. I just don't bother talking to them, because most Americans know they're silly. They are silly, and most of this debate is silly.
It's just that the tail sometimes wags the dog.
Of course. Here
in San Diego, they're trying to get a cross down from Mount Soledad. Now, it's not really going to hurt my faith if a cross is removed from Mount Soledad. I personally don't need the cross. I was raised Jewish. I'm a converted Jew, so I went without crosses for a good deal of my life. It's just that I know this isn't where they're going to stop.
Of course not.
And even when we're talking to an atheist, if perhaps they are not going to respond, sometimes the people listening will. But back to the politicians, they are amazing. Most of our politicians would claim some kind of religious faith. Almost everyone I've ever heard has claimed that they're personally against abortion, for instance. It's amazing. They're all against abortion, but they don't want to vote against abortion. They're against it, but they don't want to vote against it. There is an inconsistency there.
Well, there's a lot of inconsistency in the logic of the left. We taped this on the occasion of a Sunday night service in 1,000 churches across the country, where the majority leader is going to speak to this collected group of people about what it is that the judicial controversies are about. And this is being proclaimed as somehow discriminatory, as somehow very dangerous to the American people. And the fact of the matter is, it's not, and it's absurd to say that it is, and it's just part of the ongoing attempt to marginalize people of faith in this country and to make it appear odd or somehow out of the mainstream. That's one of the favorite phrases of the left. In fact, out of the mainstream is where the atheists are, where the hard left is, where people who wish to deny a faith as a vibrant and important part of people's lives are. And I think it's important to resist it quietly, calmly, but with goodwill, and hopefully turn them around.
Mm-hmm. In fact, one Democrat pronounced the event again as a blatant assault on the federal principle of separation of church and state. And the purpose, actually, of that Justice Sunday, correct me if I'm wrong, Hugh, is to demand that the Senate confirm judges without inquiry directly or indirectly into their religious beliefs.
That is exactly what it is. It is to stop particularly the religious bigotry directed at William Pryor, who's a devout Roman Catholic, former Attorney General of Alabama, presently sitting by temporary appointment on the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals in the southern part of the United States. And Chuck Schumer of New York is opposed to him because of his, quote, deeply held beliefs. In another context, it has been made clear that those deeply held beliefs are his Roman Catholic catechism concerning the life of the unborn in the womb. And so the fact of the matter is, this is a religious test. It's prohibited, actually prohibited, in the text of our Constitution. Article 4 says we will not impose a religious test upon people serving in office in the United States, and that means It does not matter if you're a Jew, a Buddhist, a Catholic, a Protestant, a Hindu. We will not take that into account. You may not be discriminated on that basis, but that's what a small group of Democrats lodged in the United States Senate, led by Patrick Leahy, the chair of the Judiciary Committee, led by Barbara Boxer of California, are in fact doing.
And secular people quote that clause all the time, that a religious test should not be imposed upon them to have to be a Christian, but it never seems to work in the reverse for them.
Yeah, and it's just bad law. A lot of people reveal their ignorance the moment they start talking about the Constitution. They just don't understand.
Yeah. Well, you know what? Actually, speaking of the Constitution, I have a question for you. Thomas Jefferson warned repeatedly about the out-of-control judiciary that would destroy the Constitution along with American fundamental freedoms with the Mayberry, I guess it was, versus Madison case?
Yes.
Yeah, Marbury versus Madison.
Okay. And basically, he said it's a very dangerous doctrine to consider the judges as the ultimate arbiters of all constitutional questions.
I was watching, Sharon, an interview with Justice Scalia today, in which Justice Scalia said, over the last 60 years, the courts have departed from the role that Chief Justice Marshall intended for them in Marbury, which was to say what the law was when there was confusion or ambiguity. Not to create the law, but to, you know, there's sometimes we don't know how to apply the First Amendment to the Internet. So you've got to apply the First Amendment to the Internet, and that's a job for the court. Mm-hmm. However, he said over the last 60 years, Americans have realized that courts have become legislators. They're making up stuff. Yeah. Every single day they're consulting foreign law. They're striking down prohibitions on sodomy. They are demanding that no juvenile be put to death in the United States, no matter how heinous the crime, no matter how close to the age of 18. Mm-hmm. And they are upset that the courts have, in fact, become elected officials who never go through elections.
Right.
And that is what it's about.
Well, what recourse then, Hugh, does Congress have to restore the balance of power between the branches? Is there any recourse?
Yes, it's in the form of new judicial appointments, and that means selection of good judges by the president to nominate and a healthy, serious center-right conservative majority in the Senate to confirm them. It means breaking the illegal filibuster, which has been practiced by the Democrats for the last 2 years. You know, I want your audience to understand that over the past 103 years, all of the last century, the first 3 years of the new century, there was exactly one day in all that time, more than 38,000 days, one day on which the United States Senate refused to vote up or down a judicial nominee who had made it to the floor of the Senate. And that was because I think they wanted to spare a sitting Supreme Court justice by the name of Abe Fortas embarrassment because he had been nominated by the lame duck Lyndon Johnson to become the Chief Justice of the United States. And they did not want to embarrass him, so they refused to close debate. And then he figured it out, and he quit. He threw his name, and he quit the court because he was ethically impaired. That was once in 103 years. In the last 2 years, Democrats have 20 times, refused to vote on a judicial nominee, employing a rules dodge, a card shark game, a three-card Monty, if you will, of the Senate rules, to avoid their constitutionally obligated role to advise and consent or not to consent to the president's nominees.
And somebody send them a memo and tell them that they're the minority party.
That's happening. I think it's going to happen in a week or so.
The dog. But don't the Republicans just roll over and play dead? I know I'm generalizing. They haven't all, but it seems like Republicans are always worried that if they fuss too much, the press is going to paint them in a bad way. And I think the press is going to paint the Republicans in a bad way no matter what we do. I'm talking about, of course, the old media, not the new media.
I am very much urging Senator Frist and his colleagues to bring this to a head next week. It might be 3 weeks from now, but the collision is coming. And if there are Republicans who desert, and I'm urging, you know, your callers, your listeners to call 202-225-3121. That's Congressional Switchboard, okay. 202-225-3121. And talk to senators like Senator Frist, like Senator Spector, like Senator Hagel of Nebraska, and Senators Olympia Snow.
Okay, we got to go to a break, and we'll give out that phone number again when we get back. There is a collision, and we're going to have a collision with our break coming right up here. We'll be right back. We're back. This is Bob Siegel and Sharon Kishard. Our very special guest today is Hugh Hewitt, a man who wears so many hats. He has a background in journalism and law, and now he runs a very fantastic syndicated talk show. Hugh, I heard you last week at the Ramada Inn. You were sensational, by the way, talking about the bloggers, and I want to give you a chance to talk about your new book, Blog. But I'm also very much remembering your talk last year before the election, when many conservatives and many other talk show hosts were getting a little bit paranoid. I remember you standing up there saying, relax, Bush is going to win, and he's going to win huge. I know some people thought you were overly optimistic. I enjoyed just hearing the optimism. How were you so optimistic? You seemed to know that Bush was going to win.
I get asked that a lot, and my explanation is this. The American people have never, ever deserted a president in wartime who is pursuing that war. Just has not happened. Lyndon Johnson was, in fact, forced out in 1968 from seeking re-election. He'd been there for 7 years, but the American people did not believe him. He was not pursuing victory. He was pursuing stalemate in Vietnam, and they turned on him. But in every other instance, we've never deserted a commander-in-chief. So American history was on the side of George W. Bush. Also, I did my own little, you know, I spend a lot of time on the road. I go to different markets, and I get lots of emails from all over the country to me at hughhewitt.com. But the most important meeting I had was with my brother and his wife. And his wife is one of six girls, all born to an Eastern ethnic family in Warren, Ohio, meaning that they were all Eastern European, and they're all very Roman Catholic, and they all got lots and lots of kids, and they all go to one house on 4th of July, where I was last summer. And I went down, each of them and their husband. So we got six sisters and six husbands and a whole bunch of kids. And these are all people who ought to be Democrats. This is northeastern Ohio. This is a very, very Democratic part of the country. And to an individual, they were voting for George W. Bush. That even though they were all Catholic, and John Kerry was Catholic, even though they had been raised in a Democratic house, they were not going to trust this country to John Kerry. Hmm. And it came down that he could not hold the ethics. He lost more than half of America's Catholics, which is the first time in a very long time that, I mean, Ronald Reagan did that, but that was in a wipeout of the Walter Mondale time. And so what it showed me at that point was that Kerry had completely failed to seal the deal with his core constituencies. Mm-hmm. So no matter what the public opinion polls told me, I knew Bush was going to win. I didn't know it was going to be like 3 million votes win, but it was a big win.
It's amazing.
The Hugh Hewitt poll. I love it.
Well, John Kerry kept saying that he had this fantastic plan for Iraq, but we weren't going to get to find out about it unless he won.
Yep.
Don't you think somebody should ask him to be a good sport?
I'm just
dying to know what this plan was.
I would like to see him sign the SF-180 that he has promised to sign on many occasions, having to do with, you know, what's in his Navy records. He told Tim Russert a few weeks ago that he would do it. And he hadn't done it yet. And, you know, that's just weird. The guy is an odd duck, let's face it. But, you know, he's also history. It's time to get ready for Hillary because she's coming.
Yeah, she is. What kind of chance do you think Hillary has in the next election? Is
excellent
she going to be
chance.
Formidable? Yeah.
Excellent chance. She's going to, my prediction now is that she will ally herself as a vice president with Barack Obama, who will be a tremendous, I saw him give the keynote at the Democratic National Convention, the African-American senator from Illinois. He will generate turnout in the African-American community of extraordinary level. He's a great speaker, tremendously charismatic, hard left. Every leftist in America will work for Hillary because it's a twofer. They'll get Bill back as well. Bill's a formidable candidate. This is going to be a lot harder than the one we just won. And the one we just won was hard.
Do you think Republicans are going to be able to defeat her by doing what she does, running toward the center, or are they going to have to go a little more to the right?
I think they're going to have to mobilize every single center-right person in America, every single evangelical, every single person who wants more and not less of their money in their paycheck, every single person who cares about the defense of this country. It'd be disastrous. But she is formidable, and I believe in being objective on this stuff. I was trying to be objective last time. This one is going to be real close indeed.
Yeah, Americans have short attention spans, and we get complacent very easily, unfortunately.
Yep.
Hugh, before the break, you were talking a little bit about the Owens and Brown getting out of Judiciary Committee and coming before the Senate before the May recess, hopefully. Will Frist exercise the constitutional option if Democrats attempt to filibuster?
He will. My only question is, when is he going to do it? Because some of the senators have told me on air and off that they would really like to get every blocked, obstructed, nominee from the last 3 years to the floor at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't have them all there yet. They are missing Brett Kavanaugh. They are missing William Pryor. And so that might require another week or so of maneuver, and then there's a week when they're simply not there. So it might be three more weeks, but I do believe that vote is going to happen. Do we have the votes to win? I don't know. I go back to giving your audience that number, 202-225-3121. There are seven wobbly Republicans. One of them has already tumbled. John McCain said he will vote with the Democrats.
Oh, that's great.
Has McCain finally come out and said that?
Yeah, he defected.
Wow.
And so that means we've got a whole...
Oh, he defected. I'm sorry. I thought you meant he came back to the...
He's gone.
He's gone.
Okay.
He's gone.
Okay.
And so that means we're down to 54-46. If we lose four more, we still win. But if we lose five more, we lose the vote. Because we can win a 50-50 vote because then the vice president gets to cast a vote.
What's McCain trying to do? Does he really think he's going to be able to run for president with this kind of wobbliness?
I don't know. I can never profess to know the heart of someone. It is odd. It is bizarre. It does not make any constitutional sense. It does generate a lot of attention. And sometimes I think Senator McCain is all about
He
attention.
Loves it. He eats it up with a spoon. He loves having the journalists speculate about whether he's going to go over and run with John Kerry. And he loves to denying it, but he loves the attention.
Yep.
Now, can our listeners, Hugh, in California, call the senators you were naming off, Specter and a couple others, can they call them from other states, and will they actually listen to them?
Absolutely. And here's the message, especially for Senator Chafee of Rhode Island and Senator Snow of Maine. It is legal to send contributions to any candidate in America.
Mm-hmm.
I am going to send contributions for the first time in my life to Democrats who are opposing Senators Chafee and Snow for re-election if they desert the party. It is better to know who is with you and who is against you than to have someone turn on you at a crucial moment. This is the most important domestic policy vote of the last decade.
Mm-hmm.
And without it winning, then it's not worth being in the majority. It's not worth having closet Democrats pretending to be Republicans. And I don't know that Chafee and Snow are going to desert. I hope that they won't. I hope Susan Collins stays strong. I mean, I don't agree with them, but I believe in a big tent party. I don't want to throw everyone out of my party, but once in a while, there's an issue upon which you cannot compromise and which you cannot leave and still say that you're a member of the party. It just doesn't make any sense beyond a certain point.
Mm-hmm.
Hugh, getting back to the judges, isn't it true that the third branch of the government was there to enforce the law? We're always hearing that. I know we're concerned about the judges being put in, and I'm very concerned because if that's the way we're doing things, that's the way we're doing things. But it seems to me that part of the problem, too, and maybe part of the solution, is to go back and revisit what the third branch's responsibility was in the first place. If two of our three branches of government, the executive and legislative, could get together, for example, and outlaw partial birth abortion, or get together and pass maybe a temporary law called Terry's Law, and then some judge rules it as unconstitutional, isn't that just not the way our Constitution intended things to be?
I think there's a good argument that it wasn't. Now, of course, the law with regard to Terry Schiavo was not ruled unconstitutional. It was just ignored. They simply didn't apply it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was astonishing to me as a professor of con law. I devoted two lectures to it with my students this year, to nullification. Now, the O.J. Simpson jury nullified the law when it was applied to O.J. Everyone knew he was guilty. Everyone knew he killed Nicole, and that's why we were outraged. The Blake jury was just dumb. And they, you know, people aren't mad at the Blake jury because they just were buffalo. They were befuddled. They just weren't very good.
It's amazing. You have to go to law school to be a lawyer and a judge. Maybe we should make people go to law school before they become jurists.
Well, because then we never get a decision out
but
of anyone.
Boy, I mean, you look at the people that get out of jury duty, and I get out of it when I can because a lot of times I'm too busy to go, even though I think I might enjoy it. But it seems that the ones that have the time are the ones that are not as professional, and maybe they shouldn't be the ones making the decisions. I don't know.
Yeah, it was. But it's like that when it comes to judges. They should never nullify the law. They should apply the law. Sometimes Congress can pass an unconstitutional law. It ought to have been struck down. The Korematsu case ought to have been struck down when Japanese Americans were interned during World War II. That was blatantly unconstitutional.
Well, we're going to go take another break, Hugh, and we will be right back. And we're back. This is Bob Siegel with Sharon Cashard, our very special guest, Hugh Hewitt.
Hugh, do you want to finish up what you were going to say? Because I would like to turn a corner and talk about your book blog.
Let's go talk about blogs. Everything comes into the blogging world.
All right. Well, historically, in your book, you liken Gutenberg's printing press and the way information was no longer brokered by the church and the ruling class, but suddenly available to the masses in a relatively short period of time, to what's going on with blogs, the new media versus mainstream media. And I would love for you to tell our listeners what the heck a blog is and what factors make blogs so powerful.
Sure, you bet. A blog is short for web log. That is an internet site maintained usually by just one person. Sometimes a group blog will be out there, two, three, or four people, never more than four. And they link to the stories and the information sources in the vast amount of information out there on a daily basis, and they comment. And that's all it is. It's an individual newspaper. It's a pamphleteer. It's amazing, in fact, how they've grown. In 1999... when blogging first began, it was limited to a couple of dozen websites in the Silicon Valley, primarily, among coders, people who were, you know, the high-tech wonks who were up there talking to each other about what was going on in the world of computing. Well, today there are 8 million blogs.
Incredible.
They are growing at a rate of 40,000 a day. They dominate the information delivery system in the United States. They have toppled Dan Rather. They are the reason Trent Lott is not the majority leader. They're the reason why CNN's number two, Eason Jordan, has been fired or was obliged to resign. Mm-hmm. They are changing everything in America because it's citizen journalism. And the book is designed to introduce people to the new medium and to get them involved in it. Because I believe a citizenry that is actively engaged in understanding and discussing and talking about the news is exactly what we want.
Mm-hmm. It's a fantastic book. It is called Blog, Understanding the Information Reformation by Hugh Hewitt. Hugh, didn't you personally have a lot to do with that whole Dan Rathergate story? And I love how in your book when you type out Rathergate, yeah. The TH is kind of up in the refrain there.
Well, that was Polly Pundit started that. He's a San Diego blogger, by the way.
It is so funny. It just drives the point home. Now, I know that you didn't break that story. It was a different blogger. But I remember on your program, you had a lot to do with keeping that before the public. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. When 60 Minutes Wednesday night attempted to smear the president with the use of fraudulent documents, a poster at freerepublic.com pointed out that the documents looked a little funny to have been produced in the 60s. It's not the kind of thing that you did in the 60s. And so immediately powerlineblog.com, my friends who run that blogger up in Minnesota, began to collect information from the vast dispersed computing group in the world. You know, there are thousands of people reading their blog, tens of thousands, and sent in. Lots of them are experts on different things. And the information quickly accumulated that these documents, given their forensic characteristics, could not have been produced by the machinery available to Army majors and captains in the Texas Air National Guard in that period of time. I had a couple of emails from one of the fathers of computer science at Rice University. Other people got involved, and it just demolished it. It totally shattered the authenticity of these documents and revealed that CBS had been involved in a lie. Maybe they'd been duped. Maybe they wanted to be duped. No one quite knows because they've whitewashed it. Rather is gone. Mary Mapes is fired. But it was the bloggers that brought it forward, and in fact, probably ended up immunizing George W. Bush from further attacks on the basis of his Texas Air National Guard service.
I think
because,
it did.
Yeah, once you've been shown to be the subject of a vicious low blow, people tend not to believe other vicious low blows about you.
Mm-hmm. So some of the characteristics you were mentioning were the specialized background, specialized knowledge,
yep.
The speed at which they can gather that knowledge and do good scrutiny. And they're not working in isolation. They're linked to other, possibly hundreds of other little detectives snooping their specialized piece of the pie out. And that's what makes this so powerful, huh?
Sharon, I think you got the most important thing in there, which is the netted nature of it. There's a fellow, a theorist by the name of John Arquilla, who writes upon the future of war. And he writes that, you know, net-centric warfare is the coming wave where we train our forces to pulse their attacks. Even though it hadn't been planned, they just learn how to synchronize with each other, independently actualizing what the best strategy is. And that's what's going on in politics with the blogs. We individually all work on our own little stuff, but then pretty soon we see a pattern, we communicate with each other, and we begin to go on our separate ways, which are all focused on a target, and we destroy the target.
Mm-hmm.
Or we build up the target. I got to say, especially for an evangelical audience, a lot of great pastors out there are blogging. For example, MarkDRoberts.com, great theologian blogger, has gotten tens of thousands of people every month to come to his blog to read, which are in essence sermons and theological discussions, because he's really smart and really funny.
Mm-hmm.
TryGeekDreams.com is an athlete who's out there attracting other triathletes. RadioBlogger.com is my radio producer. Loves to blog, post stuff up there. People with talent, the ability to get information out onto the web, have become small newspapers. And they're much more interesting than big newspapers, which are old, slow, and liberal.
Mm-hmm. You know, you mentioned Mark D. Roberts. There's a few other Christian blog sites that of note that you should mention.
Oh, you bet. I like, for example, evangelicaloutpost.com. Mm-hmm. I like that because Joe Carter is his name. He's out of Chicago now with a bioethics institute, which is Christian-based. Former journalist, former Marine, really knows what he's doing. John Mark Reynolds is an Orthodox Christian from the great Church of Orthodoxy, who's a professor of philosophy at Biola. I've linked his blog at hughhewitt.com. There's a youth pastor at Bel Air Presbyterian Church by the name of Smith. And Rhett Smith is just a wonderful 20-odd-something guy who talks the language of college students to them directly. Ethos blog, which is linked at hughhewitt.com. Randy Elrod is a worship and arts pastor at the People's Church in Nashville, Tennessee, where he mentors a lot of the young Christian rock and roll stars while at the same time leading worship and arts in a mega church. Fascinating blog. Mm-hmm. And this is people with creativity. Have found a new medium in which to express themselves. And it's magnificent what's happening as a result.
Yeah, I love that illustration that you gave in your book. You had so many illustrations that drove the point home where you were saying it might sound prestigious to become the editor of a major newspaper like the LA Times, but imagine if you were in Germany in the 1500s and you were the most important bishop in Germany at the time when Martin Luther came on the scene. Isn't it true that this is the greatest information exchange that we've seen since the inventing of the printing press?
Yeah, I think that I'm not saying it's a religious revolution, but I am saying that when Luther began to pound his theses on the door and issue his pamphlets, the Vatican was pretty sure that it ran the whole show. They thought they had the scripture. It was in Latin. They read it. They called the shots. They interpreted it. And they would be that way forever. The big media in this country, the four or five networks, the four or five big newspapers, the news weeklies, they thought that they owned the monopoly. I mean, they had to get along with each other, but they were all very left of center. They all hired from the same schools. They all promoted from the same places. And they called the shots. They decided what the news was. And along comes 8 million bloggers to say, we don't think so.
Move over.
All of a sudden, move over or see you later. So the gatekeepers are looking around. There are no more gates. We're over the walls. We're in their restaurants. We're taking over their... You know, there's a website out there called Craigslist.com. I don't recommend it to people because it's also got a lot of salacious material on it. But I will tell you what the effect of it is. It has a huge classified section, which is for free. You want to sell your car? You go to Craigslist and you list it. And so now the newspapers are getting slaughtered on classified advertising as these people do it for free because people advertise on Craigslist, but they don't charge you to put it up there. So they're losing their revenue from classified advertising. It's pretty devastating.
Yeah, and I'm no longer dependent on what Peter Jennings decides I should know.
Yep.
I can go to the blogosphere, cut through the propaganda to the source documentation, find objective truth out there about a given story, and decide for myself what I think.
Yep.
Hugh, could you capsulize old media and new media? The blogosphere obviously is a part of the new media. Peter Jennings would be a part of the old. What else is in the
media
new media?
Includes, I believe me, talk radio is new media. Mm-hmm. Even the radio has been around since the 20s. The Fairness Doctrine ended in 1989. Rush launched national syndicated radio thereafter. Now there is a glut of nationally syndicated radio product. And we drive stories and we drive perspectives and we're center right and we have huge audiences. I think that the cable networks are new media, though some of them are populated by old media talking heads. But if you look at the Fox News channel, obviously that's new media. It's fair, it's balanced, it's center right. The Weekly Standard is very much a voice of neoconservatism, probably the most influential magazine in America. First Things magazine, Commentary magazine. There's and Regnery Gateway Publishing, Ann Coulter, all these new Drudge. They're not bloggers, but they're all forms of media which are not wedded to the old structure.
Speaking of media, we're going to take one more media break, and we'll be back for a final segment with Mr. Hugh Hewitt. And we're back. This is Bob Siegel. Our very special guest today is Hugh Hewitt. Hugh, this last segment goes by fast, and as a result, sometimes ends abruptly for that reason. let me take a moment right now. We're going to continue talking, but before we do, let me take a moment right now to thank you so much. I know how busy you are and how in demand you are, and we're just honored that you took the time to be on our show today.
Bob Sharon, a great pleasure. Great show. I hope you keep it up for years to come. Weekend radio is where I started, and I think people need something, an alternative, new media on the weekend, other than the recycled CNN broadcast.
Yeah, well, we're a little better than an infomercial. That's what they have a lot of radio stations.
A lot better. Come on.
Well, we sure appreciate you being here. It's just wonderful. We were in the middle of talking about new media and old media. You mentioned Ann Coulter. I just love Ann Coulter, although I think sometimes she's so sharp and so witty that half the people miss it. But she's definitely a part of the new media.
Sure. I want people to start going to the blogs. I'd appreciate it if they visit HughHewitt.com, HughHewitt.com. And I hope they start blogging. I hope you and Sharon start blogging, Bob, because I think the more people who are out there chipping away, digging away, posting their news, their views, and their links, the better off we are in the chance to preserve our freedom, our religious diversity,
yeah,
and our political hegemony at this point.
Well, I'd be honored to blog on your website. I've been blogging on my own, which is bobsiegel.net, but I've got to tell you the significance of the blogging. Until I read your book and heard you speak last week, you've sold me as to how very important this thing is that, yeah, I was already doing, but boy, we're sure going to do it a lot more.
Yeah, double down, send emails out, and build the audience. I did an interview this week with Father Joseph Fessios, the head of Ignatius Press. He was turned on to me by a 19-year-old blogger at Ave Maria University. Well, he's the new Pope's best friend in America. He's his 30 years his friend and his student. So I was able to interview him on the radio and find out a little bit about this Benedict Pope. And it's all because a 19-year-old blogger put what he knew out there for other people to discover. That's the new information reformation.
You know what? In your book, too, you talk about the different categories of blogs, and there's aggregate blogs and analysis blogs, parody, sarcastic blogs. What are some of the what is an aggregate? Can you distinguish those three categories, first of all?
An aggregator is someone who simply posts links without commentary. A mill blog is a blog run by a current or really recently retired military person, like many of my friends have been in Baghdad over the past years, like Greyhawk over at Mudville Gazette. Polybloggers are like me. We focus primarily on politics. God bloggers are theologians, pastors, preachers, neo-church workers who want to focus most of their energy and attention on Christian subjects or other subjects related to religion. There's cooking blogs, there's travel blogs, there's even a blog for a guy who likes to grill food at the campground called Around the Chuck Wagon. So they're
That's
out
great.
There. Just Google up your subject and add the word blog and it will show up.
Fantastic.
Let's
see. Some of the blogging jargon that you talk about in your book, I just wanted to put this out there to our audience. What's the importance of keeping the ball in the air?
Now, keeping the ball in the air means posting a lot. You want to make sure that you're out there because people don't go back to that which isn't updated. So you got to update 4 or 5 times. A blog swarm is when a lot of blogs circle around one subject, and an opinion storm is when mainstream media sees a blog swarm and then is attracted to it with their overwhelming resources, puts video out, puts attention on it, begins to break down the walls on that particular story.
And then mainstream media seems to like to spin it and make it look like they came up with it in the first place.
Yeah, there's often a lot of people out there who are arguing that it was all about them. And you know what? There was a sign on Ronald Reagan's desk. There's no limit to how much you can accomplish, provided you don't care who gets the credit.
Well, it's amazing. What's the old saying? Success has 1,000 fathers, but failure doesn't even have one.
That's right.
Absolutely amazing.
Well, we're down to our last 30 seconds, Hugh. What would you like to leave our audience with?
I'll just come visit me at HughHewitt.com, HughHewitt.com, and then call your Congress, your senators, 202-225-3121. Tell them to end the filibuster. Thank you, Bob. Thank you, Sharon.
Thank you, Hugh.
You're welcome.
Hugh Hewitt's on every day, every weekday, 3 o'clock Pacific time. Hugh, thanks again.